This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Can you imagine a tree 130 feet around at the base, 40 meters in circumference? Can we communicate with the giants? Our first guest, Julianne Sky Arbor, takes us on a world tour of love for the trees and forest therapy. Trees are good. The more the better. But can planting billions more trees save us from dangerous climate change? Could it reduce the carbon in the atmosphere? Find out in our second interview with German scientist Dr. Lena Boysen. This is Radio EcoShock. We humans have a long and storied relationship with trees. Our nearest relatives, the apes and the chimps, still call them home. Our short history is loaded with worship of trees, woodcraft and lumber, tree medicines, and a long list more. But public knowledge and reverence for trees declined as we went inside and now we ride around in machines. For some, it's coming back as people seek out the forest elders on this planet. You can hire a guide, or you can visit some of the great giants with arborist Julianne Sky Arbor. Her new book, Tree Girl, Intimate Encounters with Wild Nature, takes you to spectacular trees in many parts of the world. Julianne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
All right. Now, you find an astounding tree, and your job is?
To engage with it as another living being and create a connection of intimacy that will benefit us both.
And I think it works. Your body with the tree gives us the scale of what we are looking at, and it gives us a feeling of your reading of that experience as art, and it tells us about the relationship of humans to trees. So how did you get started on this intimate tree journey?
Well, I would say, Alex, it's probably in my soul. Although I grew up in the Chicago suburbs, and I didn't really have a connection with nature until I moved to California in 1993. And then I, like most people who move out west where there's still some wilderness left, at least in the United States, I was astounded by the beauty and the grandeur and the magnificence of these living beings. And I wanted to connect with them and learn more about them. So I bought just about every book there was about trees that existed, and at that time there were many books by Thomas Pakenham. Tree lovers out there will know those books, and those were some of the first picture books of the biggest trees around the world. And I thought, wow, like I felt such a connection with them just by looking at the pictures. I knew I had to meet them, so I went on a quest to meet these trees. And then as my process went along for years, I decided to become a certified arborist so that I could learn more about how trees work, how they live, how they die, all about forest ecosystems. And it's become an obsession, really a healthy obsession, I think, to hunt down these trees all over the world.
Well, just like in California, we have some magnificent giants on the northern coast of British Columbia where I live. And that includes a yellow cedar that was over 1,800 years old before it was, unfortunately, cut down. It was the oldest tree in Canada. What is the oldest tree in the world?
The species or the individual? It's actually quite debatable. We could say it's the bristlecone pine in the California White Mountains. It's been estimated over 5,000 years. Of course, that tree was cut down, and that's how they just found out that that tree was that old. There are also talks of the European yew being that old, being 4,000 to 5,000 years old. And then there's other trees popping up in different countries that are claiming to be different ages. And then there's also the talk of trees cloning themselves from underground. So over thousands of years, it may not be the same individual tree, but the rootstock, so to speak, can be up to 8,000 years. There's a tree in, there's a kind of, I think it's a pine tree in Sweden that is estimated 8,000 years old. So age is really a tricky thing.
And, you know, those trees do have a built-in memory. Scientists can measure rainfall and dry years, storms, even past climates in the tree rings and in the structure of trees. The way they grow tells us so much. Julianne Sky Arbor, do you also follow the science of trees?
I do, and I'm just starting to learn about forestry and climate change, and we have to, don't we? It's what's at hand. So it's important to know because many of the trees in the world are dying, many of the species, many of the forests are dying. And so, yes, I'm starting to learn about that. But some of the science that I'm really interested in, I think is more accessible to people, is the science of human health and trees and how trees can benefit us physically and psychologically. And the science behind that comes originally out of Japan in the what's called forest medicine. I don't know if you've heard of this, Alex, but it's been going on in Japan since 2004, where the Japanese have been doing tests with people in different ecosystems and different activities regarding forests and trees. And they're finding all this evidence of the health benefits of spending time in nature, that being lowered blood pressure, lower cortisol levels, meaning lower stress hormones, lower heart rate, and improved immune system. And part of the science of the immune system benefits are that certain trees and certain plants give off certain chemicals that are antimicrobial, antifungal, antiparasitic, and we breathe those in, and those actually boost our immune cells that kill cancer. So when you think about pine sol, the original pine sol that we grew up with years and years ago, the pine oil in that is a disinfectant. So that's very interesting science about the benefits of trees and how, and then that leads us to, you know, how nature works in general, that it is a self-tending, self-healing system.
Well, I've got a whole bunch of questions for you about forest therapy, and I want to get there in just a few minutes. But first, I've been poring through your tree photos over the last few days, and it brings back memories of the very few great trees that I've seen, like the angel oak in Charleston, South Carolina. That memory has never left me. And even if we're not overtly religious, why do you think some trees evoke such a sense of awe in us?
Well, I think we all search for something greater than ourselves because we don't realize our own potential. And when we meet and recognize another being that is living its full sense of self without self-criticism, without self-doubt, without ego, we recognize the potential of life itself. I think it's kind of an unconscious connection. I think it is a spiritual connection. I think it has to do with the life force energy that exists, you know, the life force energy that Chinese physicians call qi, and many people in spiritual systems have different names for. But in my experience, comparing a small tree to an old large tree, the older large trees have this presence that comes not only from its mass, but because these organisms are connected so deeply with everything else. And that is what the trees have shown me. It's not that a tree thinks of itself as one individual. It doesn't even consider itself one individual. It's only there because of its connection to the soil, to the rocks, to the minerals, to the microorganisms, to the plants around it, to the birds, to the wind, to the sun, to the rain. And when you think about it, we aren't separated from trees or other organisms at all. There's a constant exchange of molecules between us in water and air. And where does one tree end and we begin? There's really no separation. So it's really actually a very spiritual experience. I think anyone who's been in pristine wilderness has that experience.
And people worshiped trees in the past, or worship took place in and around trees. There were sacred groves in the Greek literature, in the Roman literature, in the Egyptian literature. And I guess the Celts are the most famous with their relationship with trees, and the Druids.
Well, according to us, because most of us are from a Western heritage, and it's not that far from us, but I think any culture that lives with trees lived with trees, and that's anybody except people who lived in extreme deserts or Arctic regions, have had a sacred relationship with trees because trees were part of their and are part of their community. They depend on them and they exchange energy with them. And I believe that our ancient ancestors also communicated with other organisms, especially trees, and in a way that we have forgotten in our modern world.
Well, you bring up a good point about Eurocentrism. I mean, I have read that Krishna in the Hindu religion rests in the banyan trees. And of course, the Buddha got his great enlightenment under the banyan trees. So it is spread around the world wherever there are trees. In my reading, it seems like there are a lot of stories about female divinities who became trees. What do you make of that?
We could say that women are closer to nature. That's been said. And it might be that those people who wrote those stories were men. And they worshipped women, and they saw their connection with nature, and perhaps they were envious of it or romanticized it. But I believe women have a deeper connection with nature, but I don't think it's impossible for men to have a connection with nature.
Well, we have the legend of the Green Man that you talk about in your book.
In my book, I talk about my relationship with the trees in a sort of goddess relationship, and that I'm on the hunt for the male archetype. So if we think of Mother Nature as being female in Gaia and the Earth being female in its different characteristics and abilities, then the male counterpart is in the northern hemisphere in Western civilization in Europe, particularly the Green Man, although he has been found in other civilizations, which is a face generally composed of leaves, surrounded by leaves and other vegetation that has shown up in medieval, particularly ancient Romanesque to medieval architecture. And then he disappears as a decorative ornament once the Renaissance comes. And I think that is because we became so science-oriented, or science became the new religion, and people forgot about the animism of the natural world, which people all over the world in pre-civilized societies, that was the paradigm, that nature is alive with spirit.
I think we have to remember, too, that the Catholic religion, Christian religion, wanted to get rid of all sorts of tree worship. They cut down some sacred groves, and the only thing we've got left is the Christmas tree.
That's true. And I've gone on a lot of tree hunts in Europe, and you can find really big old trees in cemeteries and monasteries and churchyards because they allowed those trees to be representational for rebirth, and as in the rebirth of Christ and the trees of immortality. But there's lots of trees of immortality all over the world. It's a whole fascinating world of history and mythology and culture and deep connection. But I don't think our connection is over. I think we've just, we've lost it. We've become bonded with our phones and our computers and our cars and our technified way of life. But I think everyone's pretty unhappy with that.
Well, you are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is Julianne Sky Arbor, also known as Tree Girl. She finds spectacular trees and melds with them in her natural state in a new book. Let's talk about the stars of this show. How big around do some trees get?
Well, the trees in my book, I have some of the biggest, widest in circumference trees in the world in my book. Although it's not, though, the greatest in diameter. The greatest tree in diameter is the Montezuma cypress in Mexico, and I don't have that measurement with me. But in my book, I talk about the African baobab, Addisonia digitata, and the greatest girth of that has been measured at 118 feet, or 36 meters, which is pretty big. They're quite elephantine-like trees. They're kind of blobby. They're not necessarily circular when they get that dimension. And then here and on the west coast, we have, of course, the coast redwood, and inland we have the giant sequoia, and those have been measured at the largest at 91 feet in circumference, or 27.7 meters. And interestingly enough, sequoias were always thought to be the bigger than the coast redwoods, but in fact, they've just recently found some coast redwoods that are as large in girth. So we can imagine what may have existed thousands of years ago, even thousands and thousands of years ago, there might have been some really big coast redwoods here in California. And then in New Zealand, the kauri tree is their really big tree, which is their comparable to our redwood, and that's gotten measured at 80 feet in circumference, or 26 meters. And then you guys up there on the west, in the Pacific Northwest, have the Sitka spruce, and I have one of those in my book, and I have one of those. The measurement I have is 50 feet in circumference, or 15.24 meters, which is nowhere as big as the baobab, but still, they can get to be quite impressive trees.
We're talking about trees as big as buildings, really. Do you want to tell us about a couple of trees that you have loved, ones that sort of stand out in your mind when you go back?
Well, I have great memories with all of the trees that I've experienced, but I would say the book that's on the cover, which is the African baobab, which I just mentioned, that is the tree that I got to spend the most time with. I got to spend several days with that tree because there weren't a lot of people around, and that is one of the challenges of being a tree girl, is it's hard to be naked in nature when there's people around. So I got to spend some really intimate times with those trees. And as I mentioned before about the interconnection of all of trees and all life, is that that is the greatest gift that that tree gave me, is that I usually am awestruck when I first encounter a tree, and I praise it and I compliment it. I say, wow, you're so big, you're so magnificent, you're so amazing. And in terms of my own experience of interspecies communication, what I get back from the trees instantaneously is when I present myself to the tree and I say, wow, you're so amazing. Usually the tree comes right back at me with something like, no, 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 it's not me. You know, it's everything. I'm only as big and impressive only because I'm connected to everything else. And that was the greatest experience of interconnection that I ever got. I got it spiritually, viscerally, emotionally. I felt it. And this tree that's on the cover of my book was probably about 2,000 years old, although they can't really measure the age of baobabs because there's no determinant rings. So I found out that this tree died on the Internet. On the Internet one day, I found out that this tree, because it's a really famous tree, died. It just collapsed upon itself. It had six major stems, and it just collapsed open, sort of like a lotus blossoming. And they don't know why. It was probably just from the weight of itself. And I had so much grief, Alex, when I heard that this tree had died. It was as if you had opened the paper one day and a teacher or a mentor or a spiritual guide or someone who's very influential in your life, you found out that they had passed and no one had told you. I had so much grief over this tree, probably as much grief as I had over my parents dying, quite honestly. And then I remembered what I know about baobabs is they live in all over continental Africa, but this tree was in the Kalahari Desert. And because this tree is mostly made of water, when it dies, it decomposes rapidly. It gets eaten by microorganisms, and elephants love to eat it, and everything loves to eat it. So these trees, they decompose rapidly to the point where you could go back to this location right now and possibly not find any trace of this tree, this massive, massive tree. So it's not like the trees of the Pacific Northwest or the West Coast, like where you can go in the rainforest and you've seen a tree and it's fallen over and there's a little sign saying this tree died, you know, 500 years ago and it's still rotting away, or maybe it's not rotting away. But this tree could very well be gone. And to me, that was so symbolic of what the tree had shown me, my experience with the tree, that it's connected with everything else. And indeed, it had gone back into the Kalahari Desert. It was one with everything. It was one with the rocks and the plants and the microorganisms and the stones and the wind and the people and everything. It was one with everything. And I think that's a really important thing for us to remember, is that all of life on Earth is ephemeral and it's sacred and it's in its own cycle of life, and we can't take it for granted. And once we feel connected to something, we absolutely don't take it for granted. We feel it. And that's part of the reason that I do forest ecotherapy and I do this book and I talk to people about connections with the earth and the tree, the trees especially. That is such a precious connection that can change the story on the trajectory that we are on in civilization right now. If we just remember our connection to the earth, that we are the earth, we are nature, there's no separation between us, and we could, you know, we're going to dissolve right back into the earth as well. So that was probably one of the most profound experiences I had.
What is forest therapy, really?
Well, forest therapy, you've probably heard of equine therapy or wilderness therapy or horticultural therapy, right? They've been around for a while. And the gist of that is that nature does the healing. There are facilitators, there are therapists, but basically it's the wisdom of the more than human world and the mystery of that that is facilitating healing in people, once again, because we really are nature. So forest therapy was developed in Japan as a way to reduce stress in a very stressed out country.
What do they call it?
They call it forest bathing or Shinrin Yuku. And what it really is it's a walk through the forest, but you're engaging all of your senses. It's not exercise, but you're breathing in those fighting sides, and there are certain things you can do to make sensory contact through all your five senses with the forest. You know, for us, we do things like hiking over here in the Western world, but in Japan, it's more formalized, and it's more based on the different traditions of Japan, let's say Buddhist walking meditation or Shintoism. It's a more sacred experience. It's more mindful, you could say. So I have developed my own form of forest therapy, which also includes work beyond the five senses, which are more the intuitive senses, the psychic senses, the shamanic senses, the energetic senses. And so I lead people on these walks, and they're very gentle walks, and we make stops along the way, and we connect with the life force energy of that place. And what happens is you forget about all the things that your human monkey mind is obsessed with, and you experience pleasure, all the different sensory pleasures of being in nature, and it's extremely healing.
Julianne, do you do guiding yourself these days?
I do. I guide walks. I just led one yesterday. And then I also do retreats for women where I take them out into nature and we do long-term immersive experiences. And then I also photograph them naked if they so choose. But being photographed naked is not, it's not part of forest therapy. But it's my own form of forest therapy that I do for myself. So I realized I've been taking these pictures of myself naked with nature and trees for 20 years, and then I discovered forest therapy. And I'm like, oh, this is my own kind of forest therapy. And that I'm self-facilitating. And it's incredibly healing because it's very, very tactile. You know, you're getting in very close contact with the trees and the forest.
Well, you know, personally, I have gone to a grove of trees with a lot of questions or problems in my mind and just sat there for a while, and somehow answers seemed to come into my mind. Have you had that kind of communication?
Absolutely, all the time.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. And what I found is that the answers, I don't know if you found this, but the answers seem to be extremely simple and straight to the point. Have you found that?
I have. And I've also heard that you had 7 tips for rewilding, but I couldn't find them online. Can you give us a couple of tips and tell us where we can find you online?
Absolutely. So forest therapy is one of the ways that you can rewild yourself, and you don't necessarily need a guide. You could just do it yourself. So that's one thing. I also recommend learning how to climb trees, either free climbing or with ropes, and there's lots of organizations and professionals that can help you do that, and even for handicapped people, there's resources. So that's another rewilding tip. Also, becoming your own naturalist is a tip, is something you can engage in, just simply discovering, collecting things, researching, learning about them, being in a state of awe and awareness, and being like a little citizen scientist, or not little, I meant, you know, you know, being just discovering for yourself. And also traditional ecological knowledge is making a huge comeback. That's ancestral technologies, things like how to identify edible plants and make things out of them and making fire and...
And medicines.
And medicines, right. And that's one thing about my book is that I have the ethnobotany of all 50 species in my book, and it talks about the traditional uses of these trees. And I just want to take a little side note and say one of the trees you guys have up there, the western red cedar, Thoya plicata, I don't know if you realize this amazing tree, which of course, you know, is known as the cedar, and the people of your region, you know, obviously it was a staple plant for them for thousands of years for so many things. It is the plant in North America with the most documented ethnobotanical uses of any plant or tree in North America, 368 documented uses by Native people. So that is intimacy, Alex. That is really knowing a tree well and everything it can do, food, medicine, fiber, tools, transportation, art and ceremony. So there's so much potential for trees that we're still learning about. So certainly that is one thing you can do. But the important thing is to get out there and spend more time in nature and just make contact with nature every day. Just even walking barefoot or touching something, lying down on the earth, on the ground, and making sensory contact with your body for as long as you can stand it, you know, even if it's cold, even if it's wet, even if it's dark. Just relearn to be comfortable outside. And then things become more familiar, species become friends, companions, potential sources of wisdom, pleasure, comfort, companionship. There's a whole world out there that's so much more exciting to me than our phones and our computers. And so that's really the message of this book, is that we're nature. And this is totally, wild nature is totally accessible to us, and it desperately needs us to care about it and for it, and we can develop deep relationships of intimacy with.
Where can we find you online? Do you have a website, Facebook page, Twitter feed, any of that?
I have everything. My website is treegirl.org. I'm my own org. And you can find me on Tree Girl Photo on Facebook and on Twitter and on Pinterest and all of those, Instagram and all those. Just look up Tree Girl, Tree Girl, Tree Girl, Tree Girl, Tree Girl. You'll find me. Yeah, and I wanted to mention that I'm doing this women's retreat in Hawaii in November. So if you are a female and you'd like to get your photograph taken by me with a giant Indian banyan tree on the Big Island of Hawaii and experience some wonderful nature experiences, go to my website and register for that retreat.
Okay. We've been talking with Tree Girl. That is Julianne Sky Arbor, a certified arborist and conservation educator, as you've heard. And because of greenhouse gas emissions, I don't recommend you travel around the world seeking out all the great trees that she did. But instead, you can find the trees near you, and you can enjoy Julianne's collection in her book just out, Tree Girl, Intimate Encounters with Wild Nature. Julianne, thank you so much for visiting with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Some scientists, including guests here on Radio EcoShock, have suggested we could plant enough trees to reduce the overburden of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. We like the idea. It's our friends, the trees. It's green geoengineering, perhaps. But as we'll hear in our second interview, German scientist Dr. Lena Boysen led a team that tested that idea out. Dr. Lena R. Boysen is from the Land and the Earth System at the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Hamburg, Germany. She is also associated with Humboldt University in Berlin and the Potsdam Institute. We reached her at a conference in Brussels. Lena Boysen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Lena, are we getting more desperate? Is geoengineering a growing discussion among climate scientists?
I would say that it's definitely more and more popular topic among climate scientists, and there are more projects dealing with this topic, actually. But I wouldn't say if it's too desperate or not, but we need to know what the options are, and there are advocates for geoengineering, and we need to know if it could work at all and what the positive or negative feedbacks might be for us. Yeah, so it's investigated right now in different parts of the world, and I was part in a big project in Germany, a priority program on climate engineering. And yeah, we are looking at climate engineering really without having any pre-assumptions if it could work or not, or if it should work or not. We're just interested how the climate system and the Earth system might react to such proposals.
Well, before we get to your new science, we are going to talk about that. I want to step back to your 2016 paper that you co-authored with Dr. Vera Heck at the Potsdam Institute. And that paper asks, is extensive terrestrial carbon dioxide removal a green form of geoengineering? And what do you think? Is it?
So first of all, terrestrial climate engineering, what we mean by that is that we plant biomass plantations, so fast-growing trees or grasses that are harvested on a regular basis. And so it seems that this technique of extracting carbon from the atmosphere through plants is a very green technique, really. What my colleague investigated there is if it's really green in a way that biogeochemical processes on the planet are not affected in a negative way. And she found out that the effects on water fluxes, on nitrogen fluxes, carbon fluxes, they are of a similar magnitude as what we did before with agriculture during the last decades. However, it's in a different direction. So it would, again, not be the best option to go. So it's really not green. We would really push the Earth system into a new direction, biochemically spoken.
Okay, now you are the lead author in a paper just published May 2017 with the title The Limits to Global Warming Mitigation by Terrestrial Carbon Removal. On Radio EcoShock, Lena, we've had respected scientists and authors suggest humanity might save the climate if only we could plant enough trees. What is wrong with that idea?
So it's not wrong. So planting trees is in generally good idea. So if we reforest areas that have been cleared in the past, like the Amazon forest region, that would be a great option. Or to stop deforestation would also be a great option. But we are talking not about the regular forest that you know from your region, but we're talking about highly managed biomass plantations. So their only purpose is to extract as much carbon out of the atmosphere as possible. So these are very fast-growing species like poplars or willows or switchgrass, elephant grass. They need to be harvested very regularly, and this is a great interference with the ecosystems. So first of all, you need the space to plant these trees and grasses. This could either be on natural landscapes, so you have to clear that from ecosystems that are there right now, or you have to go for agricultural land that is maybe unproductive right now and could be transformed to biomass plantations. So it's really not about the common forest that we know. We would change the landscapes. We might need to irrigate those plantations to be really effective. We might need to have the machinery in place to cut down the trees and the grasses and to transport biomass, to utilize this biomass in the end, because it's not enough to just grow trees, harvest them, and regrow forests. So So you really have to take the biomass from the plantations and capture the carbon stored in them so that it's really extracted from the system.
How do we capture that carbon? How do we grab that carbon after it's been harvested?
So, yeah, so the trees, grasses, they store carbon in their biomass, so leaves and stems, and this needs to be taken out of the system. So there are different options, basically. And the most prominent one is carbon capture and storage. So the biomass is converted to an energy carrier, so like liquid fuel or biogas. And in that process, the carbon is captured and then stored away in geological reservoirs. So this, if this would work on a global scale, it would be a really great advantage because it's very efficient in storing away carbon. However, you would need these plants for that, and you need to have geological reservoirs for that. And right now, the technology is not in place yet globally, so that's a bit difficult. Another option would be to burn this biomass to produce biochar, and this biochar could be brought onto the fields, and this would actually or could reduce fertilizers used right now on cropland and pasture land. So this would actually be a good thing to bring out biochar on the fields. Another option would be to use it as a building material, as we did like decades or centuries ago, to replace like cement by wood again, so building houses with wood, so that it's at least kept away from the carbon cycle for some decades or centuries even. Another option would be burial of trees, so you really have to dig holes and put the trees in there, cover it up again, so that it's also kept away from the carbon cycle, but this is on this scale very unrealistic.
Well, we had a Canadian scientist who was half-joking when he suggested that we may have to cut down the boreal forest and bury it and let it regrow. I can't see the public ever accepting such a wide-ranging plan.
So what he was aiming at is that young forests are much more productive than older forests. So they want to grow. They really take up the CO2 from the atmosphere and build up sugar molecules and store the carbon in them, and they want to grow. So that's why we need fast-growing trees, and they are cut down like between 5 to 10 years, and that time span they are cut down again so that new forest can regrow. So that was what he was aiming at. And yes, so we would need large areas with biomass plantations to really have an effective climate engineering tool, in a sense that if we are at mid-century, if we are close to the 2-degree target, and we see that there's a pressure to get down the global atmospheric CO2 concentration, then we would need large areas with biomass plantations. And yeah, that's not realistic, really.
So how do you know from this study that the green way of using more plants will not be enough to counteract the impacts of our fossil fuel burning?
So we use the biosphere model. So that model is very detailed in the representation of vegetation. So we have different crop types and different natural plants, like boreal trees or tropical trees, but we also have these bioenergy plantations in there, and the model has been compared to observations, to field studies already. So we have trust in our model. So it's still a model, but we think that we get the magnitudes right in our model. So it's not coupled to the atmosphere like the global climate model. So we miss some feedbacks with the atmosphere, that's true. However, we are much more detailed on the vegetation side. And so we really investigated if we have a certain climate with a certain CO2 concentration in the 21st century, how would the biosphere react and how much carbon would it build up, or would it get too warm for the vegetation to grow? And thereof, we drew our conclusions how effective biomass plantations could be under a given climate. And we see that although CO2 is a fertilizer for plants, really, so they're more productive under higher CO2 concentration up to a certain limit, but this is not enough to really balance the huge amounts of emissions that might still come ahead of us in the next decades, really.
Well, Lena, I can see that politicians, politicians would have an easier time selling the public on plants as the solutions instead of other geoengineering options like blotting out the sunlight by spraying aerosols high up. Do you think it's time with your paper to warn politicians and perhaps the public that there is no such easy way out, a one-stop solution like that?
Yes, that's true. So we really emphasize that there is no way around cutting down emissions now. So there's really no option. And yeah, also other climate engineering methods, one might say that they could postpone our action for a certain time, but there is no cure to the climate change problem, really, and it might run away. So, yeah, we want to pressure that biomass plantations also can only be effective if the emissions are reduced simultaneously by huge amounts, so that the biosphere cannot balance so many so high emissions that we put out there right now or in the future. So it's really important to cut emissions now.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is the German scientist, Dr. Lena R. Boysen. We're talking about whether planting millions of trees or other plants could help salvage the atmosphere from excess CO2, and that's the subject of an important new work of science published in the AGU journal called Earth's Future. Now, Lena, you have specialized in another subject which fascinates me and worries me, and that's the impact of dying forests. And we're told a wide band of the subtropics could suffer a repeated drought. Do you think climate change could bring mass die-offs of forests in some parts of the world?
So I just started with this topic, really, but we have seen in the last decades that there were major droughts in the U.S., in Canada, and they were mostly related to heat waves and long-lasting droughts. So researchers are still investigating how a tree really works, how water is pumped up through the roots, through the stem, to the leaves, and what way droughts might damage those trees. And they are almost certain that in future, if the climate change is really accelerating, or if we have more droughts in the future under higher temperatures and the frequency of droughts increases, then we might also have more or higher forest mortality. So trees are more susceptible to drought than if they additionally in higher temperatures. So yeah, it might be that certain regions will suffer from drought events in the future more than they did in the past because the trees are not adapted to this new climate. And then there's an additional factor of biotic attacks. So if forests and trees are suffering from droughts or heat waves.
Well, the insects can get them. We've had that here in Canada. We had trees that were impacted by heat, and the Rocky Mountain pine forest beetle killed off millions and millions of pines because it didn't get cold enough in the winter to limit their growth. So we've already seen that in British Columbia.
Yeah, true. And I think Canada has huge, huge forests, and this impact really, it destroyed so many trees that Canada actually became a net source of carbon instead of a net sink of carbon. And we are right now investigating this because most climate models, or the vegetation part in climate models, they don't have this effect yet. So it's very complicated how trees work, how they react to droughts and heat stress. And yeah, we're trying to implement this now in the models to get it more realistic for future climate projections, yeah, and to get the carbon sinks and sources right.
I think that's important to study because we've just talked about planting more trees or more vegetation of some kind to draw down the carbon. But at the very same time, warming may be killing off trees that might counterbalance that, so we don't make any progress. Certainly there's new science needs to be done, I think.
Yeah, so it's very complicated. You have so many effects around the world. You have also like shifting tree lines because the northern latitudes are warming. So you have maybe temperate trees now moving northwards. So you might have new species in some areas. We are also investigating whether new species in different regions would be better solutions that are not so drought affected. So planting, I don't know, trees from the Mediterranean area further up north might be an option if these trees are better adapted to heat and drought stress, if that region is to be expecting more droughts in the future. So yeah, it's complicated, and again, the solution would be to stop emitting carbon to the atmosphere right now.
Yes, that's always the solution. Now, one of your co-authors on this new paper is a hero of mine, and that's Dr. Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber. How did he contribute?
So, yes, I wrote my PhD at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, and I gave some presentation on my topic, so biomass plantations, and he was always on my side, really saying, yeah, this is not a solution. We have to stress this, that there's no way around cutting emissions, because it's always harder to extract the carbon out of the atmosphere once it is released. And so I was very happy when he agreed to contribute to this paper. And furthermore, he's a really good writer, and he got the message across much better than I could have maybe. And it was also important to get this perspective from the biosphere modeler, really, because all these scenarios that use huge amount of biomass and biomass energy in their scenarios, these are integrated assessment models, so they have an economic component to them. And so biomass plantations are really cheaper than other options in mitigating climate change. And yeah, so we wanted to stress that, and it was very important to him also to get this message across.
But you're not saying don't use plants as part of a solution, don't plant trees. That isn't your message at all, is it?
No, it's not. So we say that, of course, you should plant trees. Of course, you should care about forests and stop deforestation, reforest areas. And you could also have biomass plantations, but at a much smaller scale. So it could complement mitigation actions, but only in well-selected areas. So you need to make sure that these areas are not needed for food production, that the amount of water that you would need to irrigate them probably is manageable, and that the effort is not too high, so that you don't have negative impact or trade-offs with other land users in that area. And one option would be to restore degraded soils, for example. So we have used and deployed exploited agricultural soils in various world regions, and so these soils have become really unfertile. So using biomass plantations on these areas would really be a benefit to make these areas productive again. And there have been studies in China where this was successful. So yeah, this could be an option really to do that. And even on a small scale, if a farmer decides to have biomass plantations, or we have biomass plantations on his field to supply himself with some energy, then this might also be a good option. But it's not a good option to have that on a large scale. I mean, there are also monocultures, and this is never a good option.
I wanted to get your personal opinion on a couple of things. The IPCC is in between reports right now, and there are fewer climate marches, it seems to me. The news here in North America is completely fixated with political scandals. Do you think we are in a hiatus, a kind of quiet period of public attention to climate change?
Well, I don't think so. So I'm right in the middle of it right now. I'm contributing to the next climate report, doing simulations with the Earth system model in Hamburg now. And we are discussing a lot, and I think in Germany we are also discussing a lot how it could go on, and that we need cleaner energy. And I think in Germany last year and also this year already, we had so much energy from wind power and solar power. So this is really on its way, and people recognize it and people want to contribute. So I don't think that all the political scandals and wars in the world distract too much from this topic. I mean, of course they do, but there's still room for climate change discussions.
Well, it's refreshing to talk to you because right now climate science is in a dismal state in the United States as the government of the day tries to dismantle it. And, you know, I'm hopeful that in Europe and in China and other parts of the world, there's going to be even a new burst of research to take up what the United States may not be able to provide for a few years.
Yeah, I mean, we are in contact with the researchers in the U.S., of course, and I mean, research is still going on. They're always welcome in our institute, I think. I mean, we are concerned about the U.K. as well, how it will go on there with the research. So we have EU projects that really have, that really depend on the U.K., so, I mean, it will take some years until this process is completed, but we try to have the science community together and to concentrate on work and to proceed with our work. I think that's important.
Yes. Now, please tell us about the conference that you were attending.
So I am right now, I'm not only working on the mortality of forests, but I'm also in a project called Crescendo, and it's a EU project. And its aim is to improve the Earth system models in Europe right now. So it's a European project. We have 7 Earth system models here. And this project has now been running for almost 2 years, not yet. And I'm involved in the terrestrial side of these Earth system models. So I'm at the MPI. We have this model there. And we try to improve the representation in the model of land use change, of forest structures, but also of permafrost and wetlands and nitrogen cycles. So, and we get together here. We have to discuss how far we got in the last 2 years. And we have this coupled model intercomparison project. And phase 6 is approaching soon. And these simulations will then go, or the analysis of the simulations will go into the next climate report. And so, yeah, we will discuss here in Brussels how the status is of the models, if everything is okay, if we can start simulation soon, and that we are on track. That's basically the idea of this workshop here.
As we finish up, is there anything else that you would like to say to our listeners?
Oh, yes. Keep being interested in land use change, in climate change, and keep an open eye on the forests of the world. Yeah, treat them well. Take care of them. They're important carbon extractors, and we need them. And adding more to the landscapes and changing even more than we did already is not a good solution.
The paper, The Limits to Global Warming Mitigation by Terrestrial Carbon Removal, was published in the AGU journal Earth's Future on May 17, 2017. That is an open access journal, so you can read both the plain language summary and the scientific paper itself. Find links to all that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. We've been speaking with the lead author, Dr. Lena R. Boysen. She's with the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, with the Department of Geography at Humboldt University in Berlin, and the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Hamburg. Lena, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you, too. It's been a pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I was a little surprised to hear that our German scientific guest, Lena Boysen, seemed not to worry about the Trump administration's efforts to close down government-funded climate science. Sure enough, a few hours later, from the conference, I got this email update from Lena, which she's permitted me to pass on to you. She writes, "I'm a boundless optimist, but optimism does not set things right, and I simply did not realize before attending a meeting in Brussels, now that the situation is already very critical. It was an eye-opener to hear that some scientists can't apply for grants anymore, and that we need to consider much tighter cooperation with our colleagues in the U.S. So yes, I personally believe that U.S. scientists will continue their research, because it's way too important and valuable to lose it. But it will require tough decisions and tremendous efforts on the part of the global research community." That was a quote from Lena Boysen. As I said in the interview, I hope governments in other parts of the world will step into the leadership role in climate research that the United States held up to the 2016 election. We've had American climate scientists who assure me the universities will continue. Many of the top professors have tenure and cannot be fired, even by Trump. There are very progressive universities in the U.S. My main concern, however, is with NASA, which has been feeding the world invaluable data through the science satellites. The Twin Grace satellites have opened our eyes to changes in everything from the shrinking mass of ice on Greenland to depletion of groundwater under California. Some scientific satellites are aging, and now it looks like we could lose precious years before they can be replaced. The good news is that China has begun massive research into climate change and the atmosphere. More and more, I'm seeing experts from mainland China as the lead authors on important papers advancing what we know. China is also committed to developing alternative energy technology and deploying it on a massive scale. They've already started that. They're in the lead now on that, and this can only help us all. Germany we can count on, for now, as a continuing center of excellence in science of all kinds. But as Lena mentioned, with the move towards Trumpish nationalism in the UK, some science there may be threatened. Centers of their climate excellence, like the Tyndall Center and UK Met Office, are all government-funded. We need that to continue. If you're in the UK, please make sure you support that. Canadian climate science was set back 10 years, almost killed off, by the Conservative government of Stephen Harper. It takes part of a generation to rebuild something like that. Australian science has likewise suffered at the hands of the government there. Governments cutting off climate science when we need it most is strange and dangerous. It's like shutting down hospitals as the wounded arrive from a major accident or terrorist attack. I presume the drive to cut science is the result of suicidal greed by a few billionaires in the remaining fossil fuel empires, aided by a willing military-industrial complex and parts of the mining industry. Now it's up to the rest of us to stand up for science. We need to know a whole lot more, not a whole lot less. And we need to get what we know already way out there into the schools, into media, entertainment, and all walks of life. Nothing stands outside the requirement we all have for a stable climate that supports agriculture and all the species. We humans can fail at many things and carry on, but not this.
As I promised, I want to end with a poem. We're going to let Pablo Neruda have the last word. Because you mentioned this in your writing as a poem that you always have with you, and I printed it out, and I think it's beautiful, and I wonder if you'd leave that as a gift for all the rest of us.
This is called Keeping Quiet. Now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for a second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would not look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is about. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving, and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt the sadness of never understanding ourselves and of frightening ourselves with death. Now I'll count up to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go.
Thank you, Sylvia Borstein, and thanks to all of you.
Sylvia Borstein. Hear my interview with her in our show, What We Nurture, at onbeing.org.
I'm Alex Smith. Please help me get our many science interviews out to a wider audience. You can browse our past programs on our website. They are loaded with scientists explaining reality. Download them to distribute any way you can, or copy the links for Facebook, Twitter, blog comments, or whatever. The information is all free to you, unless the government tries to end our freedoms. let's get the spoken word direct from the lead scientists of the world into a whole lot more ears. Thank you for listening again this week.